Transitions podcast was created to promote individual healing and growth, and to prevent or minimize the depression, anxiety, and frustration that often comes with an LDS faith crisis or awakening. It's my ethical obligation as a licensed psychologist to note that what you're about to hear may sound like psychotherapy, but it's not. It is a practical tool to help you make your journey toward authenticity without sacrificing the best parts of your life. Mormon Transitions is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies solely upon the support of people like you, its listeners. To help keep the podcast alive or to become a member of the community, please become a monthly subscriber by visiting mormontransitions.org and clicking on the yellow button on the right side of the page under support. All contributions to Mormon Transitions are completely tax deductible and go towards producing the podcast and building communities and programs of support for Mormons like you. Thanks for your support. Hello everyone, thank you for listening to the Mormon Transitions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Christy Money, and tonight my guest and I will be discussing a topic that has been on my mind, honestly, ever since this podcast began, and that's addressing the fear of parenting, and most especially continuing to provide moral guidance for your children after a faith transition or leaving the LDS Church. I've wanted to discuss this because perhaps more than any other subject, it's been something I've been asked by people who are undergoing a faith transition and considering a step away from LDS activity. So many transitioning folks are worried and afraid that if they leave the church, they'll have a negative moral effect on their children's behavior and development. And in episode 30, that I released right before this, I've discussed some of the research and psychological theories behind this. So that's a listen to at some point, but I'm lucky tonight to have perhaps the perfect guest for this topic, my friend Emily Ellsworth. Emily is a blogger who has blogged about Mormon issues and also regularly reviews young adult books, and lives in Utah with her husband and family, and perhaps most pertinent to tonight's conversation, Emily left the church around a year ago. So tonight we're going to hear her tell her story and then discuss how she negotiates these same questions as a transitioned mother, especially one living in the Intermountain West. So Emily, thank you so much for coming on to be with me tonight.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. All right, so let's start by, would you be willing to tell me more about your transition story?
Yeah, so I guess it was a little more than, or less than a year ago. I wrote a blog post that outlines a lot of kind of where I started and how I ended up to where I was a year ago. But to kind of summary or recap that, I grew up in a very Mormon family. We have on my mother's side, my Mormon ancestry goes back to Kirtland, with the Woolies. Edwin D. Woolley was my, I believe, fourth great grandfather, and he was a good friend of Joseph Smith. And is, you know, featured in a lot of like early Mormon history stories, was known as a really prominent bishop in Salt Lake City. And Leonard Arrington wrote a book about him. And so that's kind of where my Mormon story, I guess, starts. And then, seven generations later, I come along and my family has all remained really faithful. I'm the oldest of five children. I grew up in a very rural Utah town. My dad has a PhD and teaches at Brigham Young University. And, so we moved around a bit when I was young. But then, you know, ended up in Utah for him to teach at Brigham Young University. So I consider Utah to be my home, kind of grudgingly, but we've been there since I was 10. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I was very active and faithful all growing up. I never really questioned much related to the church. I, you know, did all the right things. I went to Young Women's Primary, and attended BYU because my dad is a professor. And so there are some perks that come with that, which includes reduced tuition, which I was pretty happy about.
Indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I started at BYU and, enjoyed my time there and ended up, getting married to my husband, who is from a neighboring small Utah town.
And he and I got married, the completely, totally Mormon way. I had a mission call and wasn't going to be dating anybody. Went out on a couple dates with him. Within 2 weeks, we were engaged. And 4 weeks later after that, so 6 weeks total, we were married.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was like lightning fast. And lots of people weren't happy about that, like, understandably so. So it's an incredibly risky thing to do, and I would not recommend it to anybody because it turned out well for me, but I know many who it has not turned out well for. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I had a mission call to go to Milan, Italy, and gave that up, stayed home to marry my husband. And I guess that's kind of where the transition or the shelves and the cracking in my faith kind of started. Things were good the first year we were married. We went to several different wards. We moved around a lot that first year, and I kept getting called into primary nursery, which is not my, I'm not great with kids, which is kind of funny being on a podcast about parenting after faith transition, because I feel like parenting doesn't always come easily to me. Mm-hmm. Things were good. We were going to church. And then a little over a year after my husband and I were married, I guess it's closer to almost 2 years, my husband was diagnosed with brain cancer.
Oh,
wow. Yeah. And that was, we were married in December of 2007, and he was diagnosed in September, almost 2009. So that was 7 years ago. So almost 7 years ago this time of year, he was diagnosed with brain cancer. And like I said, we'd only been married maybe a year and 9 months, so I really hardly knew him, to be honest, because we'd been married so quickly. It was kind of like we were faced with this huge life-altering problem very early on in our marriage. And obviously my husband, I think, was 23 at the time, 24, maybe 25. I don't know. Dates are are hard. But I think he's about 25. And so it's not something you expect for your 25-year-old husband to be diagnosed with brain cancer.
No, not at all.
And I was 20 weeks pregnant with our daughter, and had to face this fear that, you know, I might have to parent this child alone, which was not what I had signed up for. Wow. Or anything like that. And when people started finding out, our ward and everyone was very kind. I mean, I had people that ran the gambit from wanting to put our name on the prayer roll to coming over and members of my Relief Society scrubbing my kitchen floor because I was too sick and my husband was too sick to do it. Around that same time we were going through this and he was getting ready to start treatment and was in treatment, one of his best friends from elementary school, one of his childhood friends, who incidentally happened to marry one of my high school friends, somebody who graduated the same year as I did, he was diagnosed with melanoma. And my husband's prognosis was good. They told us that, I mean, we had upwards an 80-90% cure rates with radiation treatment for my husband. But my husband's friend was not so lucky. He had a rare form of melanoma that was very aggressive, and they pretty much knew as soon as they diagnosed it that he wasn't going to make it. It was kind of like we were on this parallel path, you know, these two mm-hmm. couples, me and our friends. Mm-hmm. And all of our family, we did blessings, we did fasts. Our ward fasted for us. My family, his family, all fasted for us. Prayer roll, all of that, you know, and same for him. And I remember my friend's husband died after my daughter was a few weeks old. I was still on maternity leave, and and my husband had just been cleared. I mean, had just been pronounced clear for cancer. This was in February 2010. And I remember going to his funeral and watching my friend, his widow, get up and speak at his funeral and just feeling this immense sense of guilt and just complex feelings that, like, none of it was my fault. But how was it fair that my husband made it And, you know, people told us that it was because, you know, God knew that I needed my husband because of my daughter, or, you know, just all these different things. But I knew that the same, like, this, his friend was one of the best people I ever knew. Everyone loved him. He was such a kind, decent person. And he didn't make it. And it just didn't make any sense. And I struggled to reconcile it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And deal with those feelings.
Mm. Yeah, survivor guilt is pretty common in cases like these. And while you're, yeah.
Yeah.
Very normal.
It was very awful. And, you know, I obviously am so grateful that my husband is still around. And he's, mm-hmm. you know, been out of remission now for, or he's been in remission for 6 years. And so at this point, it's likely that he'll remain in remission forever, good. Which we're pretty happy about. But,
yeah. Yay.
Yeah. So that was, you know, an early scare and, you know, something that I just haven't forgotten. It changed our relationship. It required us to mature pretty quickly. Because that time was stressful for a lot of reasons. I mean, it was just like dealing with that mortality and also like trying to figure out like our relationship generally under that pressure. Mm-hmm. After that, you know, life kind of went on. I was working for, I worked for, two elected officials in Utah for almost 6 years. And enjoyed my time doing that. But, around, year four, so in about, I think 2013 or 2014, I had never finished my degree at BYU. I left to go work for Congress, because it was a good job and I didn't really need a degree to do it. But I kind of got this itch to go back and never felt quite right not having a bachelor's degree. So I decided to re-enroll at BYU because my, benefit through my dad expires when I'm 30. I'm not quite 30 now. And mm-hmm. I had just a few more semesters to go, to finish up this degree. And so I reapplied and got back in and decided to go into the English program at BYU.
Yay.
Yeah. And gosh, regardless of anything else, I love that program. I still do. Like that was such a life changing decision for me to go back mm-hmm. and to be a part of that program.
Such a great program.
Yeah. It was wonderful. I had considered trying either the U or UVU for different reasons, but mostly because of the tuition benefit, I found myself back at BYU. And I started going back to school. And around that time, I had some friends that were leaving the church, and I had read kind of their exit stories and wasn't threatened by them per se, but was definitely curious and sad. About their leaving, and it wasn't, you know, didn't really want to dive too deep into why they'd left, because that idea kind of scared me.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Because, you know, who knows? You know, I'd heard rumors about things like Book of Abraham or translations and things like that, that, you know, I just wasn't quite sure that I wanted to know that, to be honest. And so what happened was, and this is kind of one of the weirdest ways. I don't know that anybody else has had a transition because of this, but because I was working for Congress, during the government shutdown, in 2013, I was working for Congress at that point, and so the government shut down, and so I was working basically for free for a couple weeks. And it was one of those things where I knew what was going on because I had kind of an insider's view into what was happening in Congress and the dynamics. And I was listening to, and I guess this is probably pertinent to this part of the story, but I worked for Republican members of Congress, which probably shouldn't surprise anybody.
Yeah,
considering.
Probably not.
But I had spent so many years working for a party and an ideology that I just so believed in. And there were certain government officials that I wasn't working for who were telling lies about the whole situation, and particularly things that were like demonizing government employees, which I was one. And it just felt like such a slap in the face. And I know that there people are going to be rolling their eyes like, oh man, politicians lie. And I knew that, but I hadn't ever been so directly confronted with that hypocrisy in my own life. And it was just kind of one of those things where I questioned that, and then there was no stopping the questioning.
Mm-hmm. That is a unique
Yeah, I had believed story. People, and they'd let me down. And mm-hmm. it was like I had this moment where I was like, what else am I taking for granted?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Sure. And so I, you know, said I was at BYU. And what happened was is I decided to read some books on Mormonism generally. So I started with David O. McKay's book, or the book biography of David O. McKay.
Mm-hmm. And the Rise of
Mormonism. Yeah.
Okay.
And so I started there, and it was uncomfortable to read, partially because actually J. Reuben Clark is featured a few times in that book, and he's also a relative of mine.
Oh.
On my mom's side. And so it's kind of like learning some things about him that, you know, were family stories that I'd never been told. Mm-hmm. Some not so flattering things about J. Reuben Clark.
Well, and this isn't you looking into anti-Mormon literature, by the way, for our listeners. I mean, you can buy this book at Deseret Book, right?
Yeah. And,
yeah. So that must have been hard to hear about your relative.
Well, it was just kind of, it wasn't so hard as it was like, wow, this is really fascinating.
Okay, eye-opening.
I mean, my family history has been so important in my life, in my family's. Yeah, I mean, my mom, we have all kinds of stories, you know, Mormon-related pioneer stuff and early church history stuff. But they've been certain stories, which is, I think, a lot of members who have transitioned out will, like, kind of recognize that, like, we tell certain stories that give us a certain narrative, mm-hmm. but it's not always the complete story. And that's kind of what I found in my own personal, like, family history as well as church history. And so I kind of went down this rabbit hole of reading more and more stuff. And I started listening to podcasts, and I stumbled on Lindsay Hanson Park's polygamy podcast.
Yeah.
Your Polygamy. And that one, I think, was the most difficult for a couple of reasons. One, I mean, the Joseph Smith and Brigham Young stuff was hard. Like, that was really hard to hear. It was just stuff I'd never heard before and had never realized. But it also made me go back and look at my family history again, because again, I come from rich Mormon stock, and I knew that there were polygamists in my ancestry, and found my second great grandmother found a diary of her sister wife that was heart wrenching. Mm-hmm. About, I mean, they entered polygamy in, I think, only like 5 years or less before the manifesto.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's when they started being polygamists. So it was at a very dangerous time, for polygamists because of federal government pressure. But her father, John W. Woolley, is considered in many sects the founder of, or the, I guess, the person from whom, like, modern polygamist groups derive their priesthood authority.
Yeah, wow.
And I didn't know that. I didn't realize that he had been excommunicated for continuing to practice polygamy. I mean, I just never heard that before. Mm-hmm. And I'd never heard the pain from people in my family who had dealt with this, and I never realized how darn close I came to being polygamist. I mean, it's honestly just because my great-great-grandmother didn't hated the practice, and so her family stopped. But that's the only reason why. I mean, it kind of fractured the rest of my family into, you know, we have, sometimes when I see, you know, polygamous groups, I recognize last names because we've got a relationship there.
Yeah. Wow. Brave woman. So that's kind of, your great grandma.
Yeah. Yeah, she was. Lots of family stories, you know, revolve around her. She's really beloved in our family. So ultimately what happened was, is after I'd read all of that stuff, I kind of had to decide, did I believe it or did I not? And I had a choice to make. And I recognized that I had the choice that I could choose to believe it and live, you know, kind of with what I've learned and just accept that things are messy, or I could choose not to believe it. And as I kind of looked back on what I knew and my, you know, my experience with Mormonism, I decided that I, for me personally, I couldn't live authentically and be Mormon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just wasn't going to work. I, you know, the history stuff was part of it, but also just current beliefs and current, you know, policies by the church made it too difficult for me to say that I was going to be an active Mormon. It just didn't feel right. So, I told my husband, you know, I think I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he's, you know, I don't want to speak for him at all because his faith is completely different from mine, but he was okay with it. I mean, like I said, it was because of the cancer and the health difficulties, we'd realized early on that our marriage was built on a lot more than just our relationship with the church.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and we love each other.
So good to hear.
We got really, I mean, I just feel like I chose very wisely, more wisely, I think, than I realized when I was 21 and getting married, that my husband was just the kind of person that cares about people for who they are and not for what they do. And for him, my being Mormon was not the reason that he married me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same for me. You know, I married him because I loved him and I still do. And we had a kid, and all of those things felt more important than anything that the church could or was doing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, love it. Wow, that's inspiring. Good to hear.
Yeah, okay. So that's kind of where it is. I, you know, after that, I let it sit for that summer. I decided I was going to leave right around the time I graduated, maybe a little bit before. I graduated from BYU. I obviously didn't leave while I was at BYU. I finished and got my degree.
Yeah.
And I had had conversations with faculty members at BYU that were very encouraging. Several I can think of in particular where I flat out said, I don't believe in this anymore and I don't know what to do. And they said, you got to do what you have to do and what makes you feel right. And if that's leaving, then you've got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And which is not something I think people expect to hear at BYU, but I guess that's what you hear in the English department.
So. Yeah, that English department is one of the best kept secrets of BYU, such an affirming place. And
yes.
And oh yeah, I loved my time there.
Yeah,
anyway.
So I loved it and, you know, felt very, I mean, I wrote a paper on feminism and polygamy for my capstone paper. Actually, it was on, feminism and the Mormon church, and dissent. My capstone course was on, dissent in post-World War II literature.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote about feminist dissent in the Mormon church in mostly the 20th century, but a little bit of the 19th century as well. And was very encouraged by my professor to do that. And it was not it was a very critical paper. So, yeah.
Brave. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's what I did. And I sat on it that summer. And then I decided, because of a series of events that happened, that in September, I was going to let everybody know.
Okay.
That I had left. And so I told my family in person, and then I published a blog post to kind of let everybody else know.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a big moment for you. So brave. And how did it go?
You know, the conversation with my family was difficult.
Sure.
I'm like I said, I'm the oldest of five children in a very Orthodox family. And my mom in particular is very Orthodox. My father is a convert to the church. And so, you know, he, I think, is a little bit more nuanced. I don't know. It's really hard to tell. You know, it's very hard to tell. But there was a lot of pain and a lot of tears. And I just, you know, basically sat down with them and said, look, I could keep pretending, but that's not going to work for anybody. And so it's better for me to just be honest. But to be completely frank, in my opinion, your membership in the church changes nothing about how I feel about you. That's not, you know, I love every single one of you, and you're my family, regardless of your membership in the church. And I really hope you can feel the same way about me.
Mm.
And that some time and some reflection that you can come to, while maybe never agree with my choice, at least respect it. And wow. I said, ultimately, what I want is, rather than you bearing testimony or scripture, things like that, I want your testimony of Christ to be to treat me in a Christ-like way. Hmm. A suggestion from a good friend of mine to say that, and I felt good about it.
Yeah. What I hear a lot is, are you thinking of the children? And I imagine you're thinking, yes, in fact. And more specifically, on Twitter today, you said that one of the things you're most commonly asked when people hear that you've left is, what are you teaching your kid? So would you like to go into how to answer that question? Or before we do, I want to ask if you can think of anything else from your transition story that you'd like to include. I mean, wow, that was really powerful. And I can't thank you enough for being so vulnerable with me to share that.
No, I think, you know, there are probably some things that I'll insert in as I answer questions that pertain to that. But I think that's basically the gist of it. It was a really actually smooth landing, relatively smooth landing.
Yeah.
I felt like from people who were very close to me, I have, you know, my husband and a few very close friends, all of them were so supportive that it just felt like a natural move into something different rather than just a harsh break, you know. And I feel like, you know, I obviously had, and I told people that I talked to since then, that I had an intensely angry period for sure, but I was able to find ways to vent that in more private ways. So, you know, online Facebook groups were important, as well as like in-person just conversations,
mm-hmm.
With supportive people were very helpful to kind of make it so that I was able to work through those angry issues without burning down every bridge that
good idea. Yeah, you're having confidential conversations with individuals who, you know, wouldn't judge you, who you could trust, you know, let that out, not burn bridges. Wow. And thank you for adding that it was, I love how you said it was smooth transition or natural, because for a lot of people, there's a very real fear of, you know, a leap like that. And, you know, what that would look like. And I know it's not smooth for everyone, but it's good to hear the stories of hope, you know, that it does get better, and that, the world does not come crumbling down. Like, mm-hmm. I know it feels like as you're preparing for a lot of people, like, you know, this is the end.
Well, and it was sad. I mean, I obviously did feel bad about a lot of things. And one of the weird things, I think, was I felt guilt for the people in my ancestry who had sacrificed so much to be Mormon, and it felt like such a betrayal to leave that when they had honestly sacrificed so much. But ultimately, I kind of came to the conclusion that of anybody, they would understand.
Mm. Yeah, you're not alone thinking that. I've heard that before, and I think it's really affirming to change the paradigm a bit to. Because I mean, those ancestors are in your past. You know, that's who you are. You can't change it. But to shift and to imagine, well, you know, what would they think? You know, if they were here. I mean, you usually hear the common narrative, you know, in Orthodoxy is, well, you know, you need to plow through for them. But then to think, I think that's a way of turning your hearts to your fathers and mothers, to try to just to really ponder and meditate about what they might or how they might feel. And I've heard someone else phrase it a very similar way, that maybe they sacrificed so you don't have to anymore, that you know, you can choose and choose otherwise if it feels right for you. So
yeah, absolutely.
So I'm glad that was healing for you. Great. All right. Oh, I hear her. She was so cute.
Looking at a picture of herself and trying to get my attention.
Well, I think this is very appropriate in a podcast episode about parenting. So, and I, sounds are so sweet. All right. So
she says she wants me to tell you that looking at the picture of herself made her cry. Because it's a little tiny picture of herself. Anyway. Okay. Well, silly girl.
Yeah. How old is she?
She's six.
Six. My Evie is five. That's a fun age.
Yeah, we're loving it.
Yeah. So we can relate for sure of, yeah, you know, the being in a similar stage in parenthood. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, how are you feeling? Are you ready to yeah, talk about that, answering that question that you got today on Twitter? On,
yeah,
what are you teaching your kid?
Yeah. So, I think the first question I got about parenting was similar to that, and it was from my mom when I told my family I was leaving. And she said, "Have you thought about the consequences to Abigail?" And I was like, "Well, of course. I mean, like, that was one of the first things I thought of. Be second, I don't know, maybe a tie with my marriage." Mm-hmm. Because your relationships are important, and a lot of church is related to your relationships, and they're tied. Yeah. So, you know, I thought, gosh, I don't know. Like, I don't know how to raise a kid not in the Mormon church. But so my mom said, "Are you prepared?" And then told, you know, stories of family members who have left the church, who've had kids, or who they themselves have become alcoholic.
Yeah.
Teenage pregnancy.
It's a pretty common progression of events that I hear from people. Yeah.
Unemployed, mm-hmm, Democrat, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Heaven forbid.
So,
or, yeah, drug addicts. Or what is that movie about? And then they died.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? I can't. Yeah. But, yeah.
So she said that, and I, you know, I just said, look, you can't look at my, at that time, Abigail's five. You can't look at my 5-year-old and say that somebody with a girl with that big of a heart, you know, she's going to make mistakes, but they're going to be her own, and they're going to be based on her decisions, and they're not going to be based on my decision to become, you know, to not be Mormon anymore. I mean, I see her as an autonomous human being who I will teach a set of values and, you know, try my best to, you know, prepare her. But ultimately, like, she's going to do what she's going to do. And there's nothing I can do about that. And I think that kind of illustrates the difference between my parenting style and my mother's parenting style, is that I've just never seen her as a direct extension of me, mm-hmm, or a reflection of me. I've always seen her, she has a very distinct and dominant, I guess, personality, and just always has, that she's not me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, you know, an important part of adult development is, you know, the individuation, the separation, and, you are a very separate entity.
Yeah.
And, that's something your daughter will go through too, for better or for worse. And, in my opinion, for better.
Yeah.
This is it's a good sign that kids are doing this, shows that they're progressing through development normally. So,
yeah.
Yay, you're normal.
Exactly. So I had, you know, initially when I left, my idea was that she could choose whether or not she was going to go to church, that was going to, and that's why I told everybody, you know, that, hey, you know, Abigail's going to get to choose, you know, she can choose if she wants to go to church. After the policy this last November, that's no longer on the table. Mm-hmm. I'm not taking her to church, and she hasn't really asked to go to church, which is not surprising for a 6-year-old. I sometimes have told people that she went through her own faith transition when she moved from nursery to Sunbeams. She disliked church so much because she didn't like to sit still and not talk for 3 hours. So it's very difficult. And so she just didn't like going. And we, you know, have taken her a few times, and she's gone with relatives a few times, but she told me, you know, today that Sunday was one of her favorite days. And I'll tell you, at her age and for many, many years, I would not have said that because Sunday was not one of my favorite days. So she, you know, when we transitioned out kind of to go back to the, what are we teaching her? It mostly just boils down to, how do we treat people with respect? And I honestly felt that by taking her to church and doing that, that she was going to learn this kind of church thing where we hate the sin, love the sinner, which I ultimately believe isn't possible. And it was just something I wasn't going to be able to combat at home. Mm-hmm. And it was going to cause a lot more tension than it was worth. And I was afraid of her learning about the plan of salvation and not knowing how I fit in that.
Yeah.
Because I left. And I just, the more I thought about it, the more I was just like, that just seems like too heavy of a problem for a primary kid to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that how, you know, they say families can be together forever, but it has happened in the temple and my mom doesn't go to church. And so are we not going to be together forever? And, you know, even though my ward is wonderful, I love the people in it and in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
The problem comes from higher up than them, I felt. And, I also didn't want her to feel a huge sense of pressure to get married young. I really wanted her to develop her own individual, you know, sensibilities and her own talents independent of any of that kind of stuff. And so, you know, we don't talk a whole lot about that. You know, she'll bring up getting married or having kids, which is normal. But we talk about that, but also talk about, you know, what career she wants to have or what she wants to do with her life. And, I've consciously worked on trying to expand our social circles to include people that are not Mormon and that, look and act differently than we do, so she can have more exposure to that.
Mm-hmm.
And really get an idea for what diversity is and how to truly love people who are different.
Yeah, very important. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. And yeah, it definitely sounds like it's not that you were offended at church. I mean, locally, it sounds like things are pretty good. I mean, you've got a good set of neighbors, and it's just, yeah, you know, from your perspective, the teachings were coming from, you know, from correlation, from the curriculum that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they're just, you know, what can you do? It's in the manual. So, yeah, you sounds like you were acutely aware of Abigail's needs when you made the decision that you did. So.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, like, without hesitancy, I mean, part of the reason I left was because I was raising a daughter in the church and was afraid of trying to combat the modesty rhetoric and just a bunch of these other things that I was like, you know, I feel like I can do this. Like, my husband and I can do this. People have been doing this for eons. I have so many friends who are not Mormon that have been raising kids that are great. And I just, it's not a set of rules that I need in my life. And we're kind of resetting with Abigail and, you know, going with what works for us and our family.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good to hear. Yeah. Tell me more about what's working for your family and, yeah, what you're doing there sounds interesting.
You know, we just focus on, you know, kind of taking Abigail's lead on a lot of things, you know, whatever she's interested in, mm-hmm. are the kinds of activities we enroll her in, you know, sans stuff. I mean, as she gets older, this would become more apparent when it comes to like activity days and young women's and things like that. So, you know, we've enrolled her in Girl Scouts, to make some friends and to, you know, build some confidence related to her femininity through that,
mm-hmm.
You know, with the Girl Scouts. She's done, you know, other things at school, or, you know, we've enrolled her in soccer and she's decided she liked it, or ice skating, you know, all those different things. And then the other thing that we just do a lot of is we read a lot to her. A lot of her education comes from, you know, books. As you mentioned earlier, I review young adult fiction. I also review children's fiction. And so I get a lot of picture books. And so we read a lot of books about, you know, different people's lives and different ways to live lives and talk about those things. And I'm no longer afraid to talk about or ask her about her opinion about things that would have been very difficult, you know, as a believing Mormon, you know, things related to LGBTQ issues or racism. Those things I'm not afraid to talk to her about,
mm-hmm.
as she brings them up.
Good. Yeah, you're not ignoring race.
Saying, no.
Trying to be colorblind, that sort of thing's not working. So hasn't worked in the past. So here you are, doing what's best for Abigail. I love that.
So I mentioned that one of the top questions that I've got is how she's been affected. My daughter has been affected by our choice. And it's been so interesting to me to see how differently she's grown up as opposed to how I grew up. For instance, we were in Laguna Beach, California earlier this year, and we were walking down Laguna Beach and I saw two Mormon missionaries. Mm-hmm. And I turned to Abigail and said, "Hey, look, there's the missionaries." And she was like, "Who?" And like, I realized that we haven't been to church in so long that she didn't know what a Mormon missionary was. And when I was her age, I was writing my testimony in Book of Mormons and giving it to the Easter Bunny and Santa. Like, I, you know, was crazy about the Book of Mormon and just such a, you know, I wanted to be a missionary, you know, from the time I was really little. And so it was kind of one of those things that made me stop and think, like, wow, she's, how much of, like, her Mormon heritage is she going to get? How is she going to understand that? She doesn't even know, like, she doesn't know who Thomas S. Monson is. She doesn't know who Joseph Smith is. She kind of sort of knows who Jesus is, but we just don't talk about the Mormon stuff all that much. It just doesn't come up very often in our house.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately, like, she's going to grow up, you know, when she turns 8, she has talked about being baptized a little bit. She had initially said that she wanted to be baptized, but now is kind of like, not really interested in it, for different reasons. They always change. Sometimes it's that she's scared of the water or, you know, silly things like that. Or, you know, I don't think she understands what baptism is. She's seen a few of them, but it's been a while since we've been to one. And so even though we live in Utah, I'm surprised at how little she's absorbing about Mormonism. And I kind of think that's a good thing. It makes it easier.
Yeah.
For me to kind of, you know, I'm always willing to ask questions. It's not like I left the church and forgot what being a Mormon was or how it all works. I definitely know. And so I can answer any questions that she happens to have about that. And we'll like kind of cross that bridge when she's 8, when we get to that. But ultimately, like, I haven't seen any change in, like, I mean, her countenance. she's still an incredibly bright, smart, you know, funny, thoughtful girl. And that had nothing to do with the church. That's not anything she learned from church.
Yeah, that's who she is.
Yeah, that's just how, you know, she is. She's just very inclusive and loving person. And, you know, she'll continue to be that way. And I didn't see really any impact at all, other than she just doesn't know much about modern Mormon or any kind of Mormonism.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, that's a pretty practical, result. And that, I think that'll give a lot of hope to some of our listeners who think about that a lot, about, you know, what the effects will be. So
yeah, it's certainly easier when you have younger kids. I mean, I'll say that. I don't know.
Yeah.
It would have been very difficult if she'd been a teenager. There's all sorts of issues that come with that. But, you know, I left when she, and I had been slightly inactive. I'd stopped going even before that. So maybe when she was four.
Okay.
And you know how fast kids progress, but from, you know, it's light years from the time they're four to they're six.
That's true. It's so true. Mm-hmm. So along those lines, another friend on Twitter asked you, how does your daughter get by socially, living in Utah? How do your neighbors treat you and treat Abigail? Would you like to say a little bit about that?
Yeah. Neighbors, we have not had a problem. I talked to my bishop before I left and just said, hey, this has absolutely nothing to do with you or anybody else in the ward. Like, there's literally nothing that you could have done differently to make me stay. The only, thing I ask is that you please tell, and I will tell also the primary president, please not invite my daughter to church.
Boundary setting, boundary limits. Okay. That's
because
an important part.
If she wants to go, I know where to find you. And I just, we don't need that tension. And it's as well meaning as it is, it just, it's not going to help anything. And so please don't invite her. We had, I want to say not last summer, but the summer before, we hired a girl in our ward. She was a young girl, maybe 16, to watch my daughter full time. You know, while she was out of school, and I was working. So we hired this girl, and, Abigail kept saying this babysitter and her mom kept saying, and this was when I was mostly inactive, saying, you know, you should come to church with us and you can sit with our family. And it caused a lot of tension. You know, because Abigail was crying to go to church and wanted to go with this family. And I'm like, look, if you're going to go to church, you have a family to sit with. It's kind of one of those things where I felt like they were encroaching a little.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't appreciate that. So I just kindly told them, hey, you know, thanks for the invite. But, you know, she asked to go. We'll go ahead and take her. And that was the end of it. I mean, that's literally it. And it was very, very mild as far as the missionary outreach to her. But as far as like neighborhood interactions, again, the friends that she had before our transition have remained intact. You know, she goes to play with a lot of different neighbor kids, some of whom are LDS, some of whom are not.
And you're in Provo, right? Or
I'm in Linden. In the Utah County, greater Utah County area.
So part of Utah County.
Yeah.
And, all right.
Yeah, no, nothing like that. And honestly, like, I don't know. Like, I feel really awful for people who have had that happen because I know it happens. It does. Yeah. We just never had that, you know, problem. The people that, the few women in the ward, I'm not a great friend maker. I'm not like my daughter. As an adult, I find it really hard to make good friends. And so I only have like maybe two. Mm-hmm. In our neighborhood.
It's quality, not quantity, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And they were both very supportive of me leaving. They weren't offended. We talked pretty candidly about it, and it's never been a problem. So, yeah. I will say what persecution, or not persecution is probably not the right word, but like ostracism I didn't get from my neighborhood, I've made up for in other areas. That's for sure. Yeah. But, as her relationships, they've been great. No one has, treated her any differently. We'll see how that progresses as she gets older. Sometimes those tensions show up between, you know, around 8 and older.
Yeah.
But for it's now, it's going well.
Good. Yeah. It's just so hard to predict, right? You know, what's going to happen. We can't really base our decisions on what may or may not, happen with friends. It's good to hear that, you know, that locally things are going well for you and your daughter. And, you know, at the same time for others, it's, you know, it can be a little bit more difficult, but I mean, it's, you're acknowledging for sure that, you know, you lucked out and that, you know, it's, I mean, there is hope for people who are thinking about taking, you know, a similar step that they feel is right for them. So I think, you know, your bravery and, you know, talking tonight is I think going to be maybe a shot in the arm of hope, you know, that
yeah.
in Utah County.
Yeah.
You guys are thriving.
That my friend also asked on Twitter about how we make friends now. And I think that, you know, one of the kind of lucky things about leaving the church is that, especially here in Utah County, is that there's a large group of families that are going through the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of her friends recently have been made through, you know, some of the post-Mormon Facebook groups that I'm in.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And yeah, I've made several friends, and like I said, she's super friendly. And so she's made a lot of friends with, some kids of people that are my friends. I can think of three off the top of my hand that we, you know, she plays with regularly.
Oh, wow. That's so encouraging.
Yeah.
She sounds a little bit like my Evie. Does Abigail like sort of commandeer friends? You know, when she's in a new situation, she's like, "Oh, you're going to be my friend," mm-hmm. and then you just get along swimmingly.
Yep, she's told me lots of times that she collects friends.
Yeah, like, collects.
So she does. I mean, and mm-hmm. you know, I feel like her friendships are very genuine. You know, she enjoys.
Yeah.
She loves being social and just has this very burning need to connect with people. And so to her, it just doesn't matter who it is. Frankly, it doesn't even matter what age they are. You know, she'll play with just about anybody. And so, you know, when we get together with people, she makes friends well. And I've found for me too, like, the friends that I lost because of my transition, I made up for, you know, with other people who were either going through the same thing or just frankly didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that our faith and our religion was not that crucial to the relationship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those are some pretty deep connections then that you establish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is she not feeling as scared anymore?
No, she's getting another drink.
Oh, yeah, I can relate to that too. I was talking to Rolf about something we'd seen about how kids at night become very thirsty philosophers, right?
Yes.
I need more water. What's the meaning of life? What happens to us after we die? Yeah, mm-hmm. All happens at night.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, those are some interesting observations and that I've also heard from other clients and friends that you kind of find out, you know, how deep a relationship is, you know, after a transition like this. And they become even deeper through this event. So.
Absolutely. I mean, I think of, you know, the friends that I have now that have helped me through this. And I don't know, like, there's just something so, in fact, because of this, I reconnected with a relative of mine, who had gone through kind of similar issues. She's still active at this point, but she's always been she's felt a little bit on the outskirts, and she and I reconnected because of this and because of some other issues that I've got going on. And I, you know, we've never been better friends because I have somebody who totally understands the family dynamic, that I'm dealing with and the pressure and just, you know, there's absolutely no judgment. And I just don't know that I ever had before. And not that people who are Mormon can't have those kind of connections, because you absolutely can. But for me, I've never felt, that kind of connection as much as I have in the last year.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Emily, it seems like authenticity. It suits you. You sound very comfortable and I mean, not that it was easy. You know, it was.
Yeah.
But here you are, and.
Yeah, I am. Despite, you know, I mean, things have not been perfect. It's not like I left the church and.
Roses everywhere.
It's also like I've kind of recognized that the bad stuff and the good stuff is all, you know, circumstantial and attitude. And it's, you know, there's just so little of it you can control except for how you process what's going on. And so, you know, things have not been perfect since I've left, and there are lots of stresses, but ultimately, like, if I were going to go back and talk to myself a year and a half ago when I was scared and terrified that this was going to ruin my life, you know, I'd encourage myself to do it all over again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. That's often a thought exercise that people go through after the fact. You know, what would I advise myself? And I mean, only, you know, speaking to our listeners, only you can decide what that will be, you know, in your own individual life. Every circumstance is different. I'm really grateful to you for sharing, you know, your unique truth and your story and showing up and being real with me.
Thank you.
Well, pleasure's all mine. So, is there anything else before we wrap up that you'd like to tell our listeners or, something you'd like to end with, or you feel like we're at a good spot? What do you think?
I guess I'll just say that I think, you know, staying for, you know, everybody has to make their own decisions, obviously, but for me, staying for my kid never felt good. But in the aftermath, like, I ultimately, like, I felt more confident as a parent, knowing that, like, I can make decisions truly just based on what's best for our family without having to justify that externally really at all. And that's been incredibly freeing. And I just hope that people who really feel like they need or want to leave, and are afraid to because of their kids, like, to seriously consider, like, their own, you know, resources as parents and how they can make that happen and build a network and a community of support that just doesn't have to do anything with the church if it's something that hurts them. Because I think your kids will notice.
Yeah, they're, you know, very perceptive.
Yeah, I know my kid would have, and she did. I mean, she definitely would have noticed and has noticed how much Mormonism has brought me anxiety and how much that's decreased in our conversations as time has passed. And it's just been a really good thing. I don't regret my time being a Mormon or any of those things that it's taught me. It's colored so much of my experience in a very good way. And it's time to take those good things and just honestly move on with the next step. And parenting, you know, just a little differently than I may have, but ultimately, like, the same principles and values, they haven't changed.
Of course. Yeah, I like how you phrase that. And yeah, you sound in a good place. You sound at peace.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Transitions. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us make more like it by becoming a subscriber at mormontransitions.org. Music for this episode was provided by Iris Dement.
Some say they're going to a place called glory, and I ain't saying it ain't a fact. But I've heard that I'm on the road to purgatory, and I don't like the sound of that. I believe in love and to live my life accordingly. But I choose to let the mystery be. Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worrying about where they're gonna go in the whole thing.